Radio designed just for you.
Good morning and welcome to America's Web Radio and Medicine on Call. And as anyone and everyone that listens to the show realizes, I'm not Dr. George. Dr. George is unfortunately stuck in traffic, but is on her way. This is Atlanta, Atlanta, Georgia has traffic problems continually. But we have Dr. George's guest on, Robert Smith, and this is going to be a very interesting show, and it will even get better when Dr. George comes into the room. But, Robert, you're in medical privacy. Is that correct?
Yes. I publish a newsletter called Privacy Journal. I've done it for more than 40 years, and a big component of that, obviously, is medical privacy.
And let me...
People know there's a federal law that covers it, very complex law.
Called HIPAA, I believe.
Right.
And in your case, do you cover both sides of it? Are you strictly from the doctor's viewpoint, or is it from the patient and the doctor's viewpoint?
Well, I would say the newsletter is from the consumer's point of view. But in medical privacy, I think that means generally thinking that the more confidentiality, the better in this relationship. Sometimes that coincides with doctor's interests, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, you know, from a patient standpoint, my standpoint, I can't think of anything worse than a breach between you and your doctor. I think it's a matter of total privacy and should be total privacy. And let me ask, I'm not a... At my age, and I'm old enough to be your grandfather or your great-grandfather probably, but I am not a big EMR, electronic medical record fan. All we hear about today is hacking and hacking and hacking, and I realize that there are very few people other than maybe my wife and my kids that really care about my health, but yet I hate to have the thought that just anybody could hack in, and I guess conceivably they could blackmail or extort money from folks over their medical records. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the more common thing is the hacking in of a large database of medical data in order to sell products to people and to manipulate them so that they need services and products they probably don't really need, but there's an awful lot of that going on. I too think that the push for electronic records was not worth the effort. It's taken a long time to implement. It means, at least in my case, I see the back of the head of my treating physician because he's got his fingers on a keyboard entering everything I say. It's no longer a face-to-face relationship. And you just wonder whether that helps the doctor's office to have all of this automated. I don't think that it does. And it does open up a lot of this medical data to outsiders who either hack at it or it's sold. The doctor's office is not able to sell it, but others do, and it's now become part of the marketplace simply because it's digital now.
Well, you know, not only that, but I've recently run across two situations where, you know, you feel like, okay, I have a relationship with my doctor. I'm seeing the back of his head, but at least it's still a relationship with my doctor. Now, I've had two cases where the doctor brings in their assistant to do the typing, and it's basically like the old dictation system that the doctors used to use many years ago, where they'd go into their office and talk about Robert Smith or David Moxley, and they'd dictate into the deal, and then it'd be transcribed. Well, now it's they're bringing their assistant in, which she or he doesn't necessarily fall, I don't think, under HIPAA, like your relationship with your doctor.
No, they certainly do. They're certainly agents of the medical service there, so they're covered by HIPAA. There's no doubt about that. And I think an effective physician can make that work when you have a transcriber in the room, with certain exceptions to that. But so often it's a mechanical exercise now. It's not really a treating relationship.
So does privacy with your physician start at the front desk, or is it strictly when you go into the examining room?
No, it includes everybody who's part of the relationship there. It includes the drugstores. It includes ambulance drivers. It includes other people who are part of a huge hospital complex. But there's lots of exceptions to it, and HIPAA can certainly be viewed as an authorization to share information as opposed to a confidentiality requirement. One of the huge things in HIPAA, which I think made it worthwhile, was that for the first time nationwide, it gave patients a right to see, to inspect their own medical record. And that was huge. And we may think now in this decade that that was always a right. It's always something we assume, but that wasn't true. Most doctors' offices did not permit patients to have access to their own records. Well, HIPAA does that, and I think that's very important.
Okay, let me ask, because I guess you just confused the old man a little bit, in that I've been going to Dr. Jones, and I've decided I want to go to Dr. Smith.
He's a good one. Yeah.
He's a good one. You recommend him highly, huh?
Yes.
So, correct me if I'm wrong. In the past, and this was a long time ago, Dr. Smith would contact Dr. Jones, and Dr. Jones would send over my records. Now, I believe I have to go to Dr. Jones and get my records and take them to Dr. Smith. Is this...
Well, of course, the idea with electronic records is that that could all be done by
telecommunications, sure.
And I presume that's what they're working on. It doesn't make sense to electrify, digitize medical records if you don't have that advantage. So I'm not sure that a patient is obligated to carry the actual file over to the new doctor. My understanding is, and I've had this experience a couple of times, is you just simply sign an authorization with the first doctor that... you want to change doctors, and that information is sent over to the second doctor. I think still in this point in the procedure, it's all manual. It's a huge file with a bunch of papers in it. It's not a digital record. I guess in more sophisticated doctors' offices, that can be done electronically, but you wonder for the new physician whether he or she is getting the full story when it's an electronic record, because I think there would be a lot of things in the manual file that would be important for a treating physician. I was shocked to get a phone call from my pharmacist about 2 months ago saying that he was decided he didn't want to sell prescriptions anymore, and he had just transferred all my records to one of the large national chains without consent, without asking anybody. And I think that's clearly a violation of HIPAA.
That's very interesting. And what did you say to the gentleman?
Well, I was shocked by it, and he said, well, I'm not going to be in the prescription business anymore, so it doesn't do any good to get mad at me. I think that 3 years ago that there was a similar circumstance. I was shocked when I was Googling myself, something I do quite often to make sure that what's online about me is accurate. And there was a record of my ordering prescriptions electronically through email. And I checked with him on this. He had reconfigured, or he had a contractor from out of state designing his system, and it just picked this up from people who were making email orders of prescriptions and showing up on a Google search. It was outrageous, but after that, his only solution was, well, I guess you better not order prescriptions by email. Well, that's one of the points of electronic delivery of medical records, that for the patient that should be a lot easier to do. I have not noticed that the digitization of medical records has helped the patient that much at all in terms of arranging appointments, getting forms, getting tests done, and even getting prescriptions. It hasn't reached that point yet, and it's still a horse and buggy operation, I think, from the patient's perspective.
Well, I think, you know, on the surface, I guess, you could say EMRs might be a good thing, but the one common denominator in all fallacy is that human portion of it. The person, I've had the same problems that you've had with getting appointments, and you still have the human person. You have the person pumping in the information, and if they screw it up or get something wrong, then it's just as hard. In some ways, it's even harder to go back and trace the person that messed up, find out what has to be done to clear it up and go forward. But I am glad we've got our expert in the studio now. Dr. George has made it, and I'm going to turn this interview over to her.
And Mr. Smith, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, good morning. I'm happy to join you.
Good morning. My apologies. There's a really bad accident on the way in, so hopefully the person's okay and two people are okay. You know, I'm really blessed to have you on the show, and you're coming on at the exact right moment after the news that came out yesterday about our TVs and our smartphones and all sorts of electronic gadgets perhaps looking and listening in on us.
Absolutely.
I don't even know what to say. I mean, I kind of heard about it a while back. You know, if you had a one of those kind of Nintendo type of machines and you were online, that could listen to your conversations. I know Samsung came out with a disclaimer. It's actually in their instructions that, hey, if you don't want your business to be in the street, don't be around your TV, you know, because we're listening to you. But, I mean, are we sacrificing, just a broad question just to get us rolling, for the sake of expedience and, you know, being on the cutting edge, are we really sacrificing our privacy and our security? Is that where this is really going, and it was just a red herring to kind of get us sucked in?
Yeah, I think absolutely. We're trading in our privacy for the smallest of what we think are conveniences.
Mm-hmm.
We willy-nilly sign these authorization forms in the doctor's office or anywhere else, and we agreed to give up information in order to get the service, whether it's use of a credit card or purchase of an item or entry into a public event. And people are all too willing to trade in their privacy just for this tiny convenience. I think they should hold out more, and I think they should do without some things in order to protect their privacy. People pay lip service to it.
Mm-hmm.
In any poll, you'll see a high interest in protecting one's privacy. But when it comes down to the transaction, people are all too willing to give it up. And that includes the use of electronic devices. I don't think anybody who has a cell phone pays much attention to the privacy aspects of that. They like the convenience of the phone and perhaps even the fun of it, but they're leaky devices, and people don't even take the precautions of turning the thing off so that it doesn't pick up conversations in the room, or turning it off overnight so that it doesn't remain part of a huge electronic network. Those
mm-hmm.
are just simple things that people can do, but they're not doing it.
Well, you know, let's actually take a break, and then when we come back, we can go through in more detail what people can do to protect themselves. On that note, you're listening to Medicine on Call. Go on, come on.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree ENT Center. We've won patient care awards and have the highest patient recommendations because we believe in practicing medicine the old-fashioned way. Practicing good medicine is based in listening to the patient and making a care plan that is individual. The best medical care is given when there is a strong doctor-patient relationship built on mutual trust and respect. At Peachtree ENT Center, we believe in taking care of the whole patient because healing is more than writing a prescription. Whether you have problems hearing, have frequent throat or sinus infections, from the time you call our office and speak to a real person, you'll be treated as an individual and not as an ailment. During your visit, you will not be rushed, and all your questions will be answered. When possible, natural treatments will be recommended to fix the problem. If surgery is recommended, cost-effective, minimally invasive treatment for snoring, sleep apnea, or sinus problems will be offered, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning and welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today we're talking with Robert Ellis Smith. He's an attorney, an author, and a privacy expert. And I'm really blessed to have him because he is known worldwide, and he has figured out and can explain in detail where we're going, how we got to this point, and most importantly, how we protect ourselves. I think, you know, you line up 9 out of 10 people, someone's had some experience with identity theft, you know, going to buy gas and having your credit card compromised. It's amazing. I've changed mine about 3 or 4 times in the last 2 years, and it's something that, I mean, I think I'm taking care of myself, but obviously I'm not. And we talked before the break about the bigger process going on. It's all about metadata, isn't it? I mean, capturing your data to find trends, to control or find out where you are, and it's, you know, am I thinking of it in the right terms? Because it's a bigger picture than just the individual having things hacked, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a big business now, and I guess the definition of medical data should be expanded, too. I mean, this includes people who make Google searches of various ailments to find out more about them. That's a very common practice, I'm sure, now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those inquiries are harvested, and Google makes them available to marketing companies that take the data and massage it and try to sell people products and services. People go to health spas, they go to gyms, and they leave behind a lot of information about themselves. That's not covered by the federal confidentiality rule at all. So that we have to expand, first of all, the definition of medical data to include biological information about ourselves that we leave behind. I think we just have to be very wary of any come-ons that we get either by email or through blogs or through old-fashioned postal mail. Because it's based on tracks that we have left prior to that time that indicate some interest in a particular ailment or disease.
And knowledge is power, really. I know that as a physician, if we write a prescription, the reps that came in, they knew exactly what prescriptions we were writing, how many we were writing, and we weren't even aware of that. You know, you're just with the patient, you're just doing your daily duties, but that information is golden, apparently. When you send the prescription electronically, the pharmacies get that. And again, I think the anonymity of what's going on in your office, that's gone. It's not locked anymore in a chart that you're writing on. It's out on the web and for everybody, if they want to and if they can, to see. What's the upside?
I'd like to interject here that we should realize that a lot of information that we think is cumulative actually can be manipulated so that it does identify individuals by combining it with other databases, so that a database of all those people, just the type of prescriptions that you're writing, if that falls into some other hands, that can be combined with information about zip codes and census information and a lot of other things to actually zero in on the individuals who are getting these prescriptions.
And how far does that go? Does that also go to people looking for jobs, perhaps, if you're looking for a government-based job or something like that? is that the degree of data sifting that they're going to do to figure out if you have a medical condition or you're on some sort of medication, maybe psychotropic medication, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of the subterranean aspect of all of this, but there are databases created by this process that are available to employers before they hire people. And whenever you have bulk data like this massaged and manipulated and combined with other databases, you're going to get distortions. You're going to get things that are not true about people.
Absolutely.
I mean, one instance is just Google searches. People search all the time for ailments that belong to somebody else, maybe somebody else in the family, not themselves. Yet if the assumption of the data aggregators is that you have the ailment that you've expressed interest in, that's going to be very deceptive.
Absolutely. I've used the example, I'm an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and if someone's given an antidepressant to help them stop smoking, it's a little bit off-label. You know, you're thinking it's just a psychiatric medication, but it's not being used for that. That will follow you from a paper trail perspective, an electronic perspective, forever. And it's, you mean, you're only as good as the data you put in, one, and two, there's no subtlety with it. It's all or none. And that's kind of, you know, disconcerting. Now, there's a trend now with telemedicine and people doing whole office visits online and prescriptions and talking with the doctor online. What about that? Is that also susceptible to this? I mean, it's supposed to be encrypted.
Well, it is, because it uses telecommunications, it is off-site, and it, once again, uses huge databases, which are very tempting to hackers and to marketers. But mm-hmm. I think it's outweighed by the value here of getting medical attention to people in remote areas, and it's probably, in many ways, a more efficient way of delivering services that don't require a visit in the office. So
mm-hmm.
I don't think that the value of electronic records is outweighed by the risk, but I do think that telemedicine, or whatever it's now called, does outweigh some of the risks here, and it can be conducted in a way that keeps the confidentiality of the patients. What I discover has been, I'm sure this has been your experience too, that privacy is the afterthought. The system is designed, sometimes even put into place, and then somebody raises the issue of privacy, and they have to go back and redesign it, and they slap on some protocols that have to do with privacy without really knowing the properties of this concept. And all the studies show that make this work, you have to incorporate privacy from the beginning, from the design of the system.
Right.
It's much cheaper that way, too. There's also a problem in not just the medical field, but every field, that people confuse privacy with security. Security is the protection of the information. It's a value that is tied to the information. It's a way of securing it against either authorized or unauthorized access. Privacy involves a quite different kind of holistic approach. It's a human value, and it not only relates to keeping the information secure, that's only one part of it.
Mm-hmm.
We talked before you came about patient access to their own records. That's part of a privacy concern. The right of a patient, the entitlement to correct a record if necessary,
mm-hmm.
That's part of privacy as well. And the getting a control into the hands of patients on authorized uses of information is part of privacy. So people who see it only as security worry about the unauthorized access to information, but much of the information that is out there is done with the approval of whoever provided it, and the right to privacy should cover all of that as well.
I'm so huge that you feel like you're tiny in this sea of doubt about whether I'm doing the right thing or what do I need to give up in terms of information. And I was listening to one of your interviews, and what really stuck out for me was the ability and the responsibility of the person to say no if they feel uncomfortable. And you used an analogy of going to shop and giving your not your social security number, but your zip code. or your last four digits of your Social Security number. And, you know, I get asked that. Everybody gets asked those things, and you just don't even think about it. But you do have the ability to say no to these things, don't you?
Yeah, I think in the marketplace, when people are asked for their zip code, they ought to say no just for practice. That they ought to get practice saying no for more sensitive information. And I definitely think they should not give up the last four digits of their Social Security number, because now with computer networks, it's possible to piece together the whole Social Security number if you've got those last four digits. In fact, for hackers, the last four are the most difficult to get. So I think that giving up or demanding the last four digits is not adequate privacy protection.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think it was. It used to be what we used to call pretty good privacy, but it's not even that. And I would counsel people not to give up their Social Security number except for really tax purposes. And that's about it. It used to be the Medicaid number, and that's phasing out now, luckily. It took a long time to get the agency to phase that out.
Mm-hmm.
But most requirements for Social Security numbers can be defeated if people show a little courage and say, I just don't want to give that out.
Well, we definitely in our office don't demand that. If the patient says that they don't feel comfortable, it's not something that, you know, we learn that it's not necessary to see the patient. So I'm all on board with that.
I think, you know, in the medical setting, people quite often are intimidated by those in places of authority, and they think that if it's asked for, it's required.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to resist that, but I'm glad that you don't, because that's only opening up your records to more possibilities of hacking, because a Social Security number really is the key to getting other information about people.
Agreed. And, you know, there's, I want to get your take on something I just read this morning about, in the UK, using robots as the, instead of seeing a doctor, they want people to interface with artificial intelligence and get their diagnosis, and the doctor will just become the technician where they treat the patient. Now, I can't imagine that that's a safe thing to do, but what's the worst thing that you think that can happen? Everything you say to that interface is it's open for hacking and for looking at, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the worst thing that could happen is that somebody sets up kind of a phony operation where they're harvesting all of this information and not providing the medical care that's promised. Maybe it's not medical care. It's kind of directing people to where to get the help.
Exactly.
And as I say, you don't want to defeat these technological advances like telemedicine, but if privacy is included in the design from the beginning, then you can have both. You can have the technology and you can protect the dignity of the patients. There's a concept that began in Canada called privacy by design, and that's what it is. It's building it into a system from the beginning.
Okay. Well, on that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you've probably noticed that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you're able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will likely continue to rise, while your healthcare choice and access will continue to fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We believe in taking care of the whole patient, because healing is more than writing a prescription. We are committed to working with you, and we specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductibles or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
This is Skip Coriel, host of the Home Defense Show on America's Web Radio. Join me every week as we explore all aspects of home and family defense, as we strive to defend the ones we love in an ever-changing and volatile world.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're speaking today with Mr. Robert Ellis Smith. He is the publisher of Privacy Journal and also other texts, including compilation of state and federal privacy laws, which I understand you can download and you can actually use it as a database in a way to, in real time, figure out if things that you're doing are running afoul or putting yourself or your employees or customers at risk of privacy concerns. Is that a good way to see that?
Yeah, actually, it was a goal of mine for many years, and now we have it available both on Kindle and on personal data assistance, where if you're in the marketplace, you're in the doctor's office, you're at work, you're anywhere else, you can just scan to see what the law is in your state that may protect you or may not protect you with regard to medical records or employment records, credit records, all the rest. Yeah, I think it's great that you can carry around in your back pocket all of this information.
Absolutely. Now, from going forward, I want to try to give people some tools that they can, things that you really should do, checklists that you should create, so that you can keep one step ahead, so you're not playing catch up with your, you know, your tax returns being filed by someone else, not you, or having to switch out your credit cards, or God forbid, being totally identity thefted. What is like the major things that you think people should do to do the health of their privacy, to see if they're doing things that are putting them at greater risk and how they can protect themselves?
We've talked about Social Security numbers. That's, I think, the main thing.
Okay.
Even to lower your risk for identity theft is to protect your Social Security number and don't give it up whenever it's asked for. Make sure that it is ask whether, why it's needed and whether it's relevant to the transaction. In most cases, I think it's needed only for tax purposes when you're generating some income. Always read the forms that are put in front of you. Always request more time. The HIPAA form need not be signed if you don't, if you choose not to, but see what it says. And you may want to write on the form particular concerns you have that you don't want information shared with others.
Mm-hmm.
Just because a piece of paper is put in front of you does not mean that it's not a contract that both sides can negotiate on. Now, I realize in a doctor's office that's good, that may slow things down, but people don't have to sign that form, and then they should be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people should be careful with their cell phones and turn them off when they're not in use. And certainly they should be more careful about what they tell their kids about the new technology and precautions, and tell them that the Internet, just like any huge city, is full of dark alleys that can be very dangerous, and kids have to be alerted to that. I believe in the rule of twos, you know, that you guys quite often have two physicians. You know, if you have some very sensitive condition that you're really embarrassed about, you might want to go out of town to get that treatment, or somewhere away from town, and that may provide an extra layer of protection.
Mm-hmm.
I think people ought to have two wastebaskets, even, where they split any paperwork that they're throwing out, so that any identifying information, including account numbers, are split up, so that half the document ends up in one trash can and half in the other, and you may empty those on alternate weeks. But you do the same thing in the electronic way as well.
Mm-hmm.
Always check out your electronic banking system. Some of them are more secure than others, but if you're getting a new one, just write a few checks to yourself and see how the process works before you use it. And But just realize that in many cases you have a right to see your own information and to correct it. This is especially important in the credit reporting field. Atlanta's the home of Equifax, which is the largest credit reporting firm in the nation. And even though there's a federal law that requires them to be accurate and to provide information only for permissible purposes and to correct information when the customer asks for it, they, over the years, have not been able to do that. There's just a new report from the federal government saying that they're still not up to par on that. So you should inspect your credit report, I would say once a year, to see what it has to say about you. Those are some of the things that are as starters for protecting your privacy. My website has a whole lot of others. It's privacyjournal.net. And if you go to our section of where we list the tips, we have a whole bunch of tips for people for protecting their privacy. They number more than 25, I think. But also we have tips for organizations, too, for how to build a privacy policy, at least, that is the first part of building a privacy structure within the organization.
What do you say about the people who download apps for their phone? I mean, they always give you the settings and turning off notifications, etc. But is there something that you should do to protect yourself from inadvertently giving them too much power to access your database in your phone or listen to you or whatever it is? Is there something that you recommend people do in that regard?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm not an app kind of guy,
okay.
So I truly don't know.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. It's something that, they have the ability to actually see all your contacts if you let them, or turn on the mic, to listen to you. Those are the things I definitely just turn off as soon as I see those as part of it. But let's talk about physical things like the Peach Pass or the electronic passes. I mean, you recommended that you just don't do the same thing. Change up your routine no matter what it is, even where you are physically.
Yeah, if you have sensitivities, you should. I mean, that's true for personal security as well. I think don't always take the same path that you go every single day. Variant unpredictability can provide certain security in your personal life, and that's true of privacy as well. If you have more than one credit card, for instance, I've always thought people should use one credit card online where there are possibilities things can go wrong. And you can easily cancel it, but it won't be inconvenient for the rest of your life because you'll have another credit card that you use physically in the workplace. Some people may find use of debit cards more of a protection of privacy. They should know that if things go wrong in that transaction, they don't have the guarantee of federal law that their liability only goes to $50 because it's a debit card. It's not a credit card. On the other hand, to go to a ATM machine and get cash and then pay for the item that's particularly sensitive for you may give you some reassurance because we should realize that there is a way to tie in the use of your plastic device at the cash register and all the items that are listed on your receipt. So if you do make sensitive purchases, you might want to get the cash first and pay for it in cash.
That's a good idea. And what about the VPN services? Sometimes, I know when you travel and you need to, have access to an IP address in the States, that's one of the reasons that people use them. Does that provide any privacy at all?
Well, I don't think it involves a threat to your privacy. I think that's safe to do, yeah.
Okay. Well, does it give you anonymity, though, when you're
surfing
or whatever?
Nothing really gives you true anonymity, I think. Anonymity is an interesting dilemma for those in the privacy field. I mean, I think the anonymity online now, which allows people to say all sorts of nasty and fake things about other people, is a real crisis, is a real problem. The Internet was never intended for that purpose, and those in my position always celebrated the anonymity that can come from Internet usage, but I think it's having greater harm than good. But I don't think there's any true anonymity in commercial transactions. There's too much of a need for a data trail for the various people involved and institutions in the actual transaction.
Well, I think you're probably right about that, especially now. It's become organized, basically.
There is also the phenomenon that it's not a very big one, but maybe you've run into it, of medical identity theft, where because of the cost of medical care, some people get it in the name of some other individual.
That's one of the reasons that we check for ID, et cetera, and if there's insurance, it has to sync with what the insurance says. But I'm sure it's going on in the prescription side more so, because it's a little bit more, you just roll up and nobody knows what you look like and you pay for the product. The whole privacy and the whole system, that it's like a grid to me. It's just the fact that everything is being centralized, it's being quantitated, it's being monetized, is an issue. I mean, as long as there's money involved, it's going to be very difficult for people to pull back from this system. Do you see any way that am I wrong about that, or do you think that's the motivating factor, or is it control?
Right. I think as recently as 20 years ago, that wasn't the case in the medical field, for instance. And institutions got really audacious in exploiting medical information for the money, as you say. And that has caused the difficulty. In the past, the relationship was pretty much an individual one. It involved a self-contained office, generally. It involved mutual trust, and I think that's really disappeared now. Perhaps it's a cost factor. Maybe many practitioners need to cooperate with some of these data bundlers, and you're right to describe it as a moving network. When you get medical treatment, that information does start to flow through a system involving pharmaceuticals and hospitals and researchers and a whole lot of others. And HIPAA makes a stab at controlling that, but doesn't totally succeed in that respect. And as long as that's the case, I think it's very important for people to inspect their medical information regularly to make sure that it's accurate. With a person like a name like mine, and perhaps yours, it's not unusual for there to be a mix-up in the files. And I found that more than once, that there was a piece of paper that pertained to another individual, not me, with a similar name.
It's funny. I mean, human error happens every day. Just because it's digitized doesn't mean it's not going to happen as well. So
no,
you shouldn't get lulled.
The electronic aspect of it magnifies the error, too, because the information starts to travel, and it takes on a permanence. And it's also a property of any digital information. It looks correct. It looks accurate because it's electronic. Unlike looking at a piece of paper, we can kind of evaluate whether it's old or not, whether it's recent, and whether it's properly signed off on. But with electronic information, it all looks current and accurate.
Funny how that is, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's take another break. And when we return, I want to ask you a couple more questions about, where you think this is going and how we can manipulate the system instead of the system manipulating us. Thank you for listening to Medicine Call. We'll be right back.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose, and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Did you miss the show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps. These are generally benign growths that occur from chronic sinus infection or allergies that are either undertreated or have not been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery and correction of a deviated nasal septum and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office. We use a state-of-the-art equipment so that you can see the problem. You will be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment. We believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. You can rest assured that all options will be offered before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Again, we're speaking with Robert Ellis Smith, a privacy expert, about the state of affairs, you know, where we are. And it's not all about using technology for cool stuff. It's about what's the downside of it? What do we need to protect ourselves against? And we talked a lot to this point about the problems and you know, how we what can be used against us. How can we actually turn the tables, in your opinion? I know we talked about watching your own privacy, you know, your social security, et cetera. But is there something, some mindset change that you would recommend or that people should start thinking about it slightly differently so that we take, you know, we use this technology and highlight and enhance the good stuff and take the power away from these forces that want to use us for their pleasure, for making money on us, for controlling us, for knowing where we are at all times? How do we take our power back?
Well, it's easier said than done. One part of the change of attitude is at the end of the process, where I think we're all too willing to buy things in the marketplace that we really don't need, and we're willing to be manipulated by large organizations that know more about us than we know about them. And they bring to bear on that transaction all this information they've gathered about our likes and our dislikes and indeed our weaknesses and our vulnerabilities. So that's the first thing, and that's at the end of the process.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do without a lot of that stuff and spend our money in wise ways. And we can tell when the transaction we're being offered is a result of manipulation of our personal information or is really something that we need. And secondly is related, it's transparency. We have to find out all we can about these large organizations that are aggregating the data and massaging it and reselling it. And that can do a lot to empower us if we know how all of that works.
Mm-hmm.
And this is available on the Internet, too. There's lots of information about this. And also the technology. We have to find out how the technology works, even if we're at an older age. We can't just simply say, oh, it's the computers or, oh, these are telephones and I don't know anything about that. We have to get to the core of these technologies and learn exactly how they work and what their possibilities are and what they are not. So many times we're deceived into being told that computers can do all sorts of magical things. And another part of that is I think we should not just sigh and say, oh, our privacy's all gone and the computer's got everything about us and there's not anything we can do about it. I've never believed in that, and I hope people don't fall prey to that, because that's exactly what these large organizations are counting on. It looks complex from the outside, but when you get right into it, it is not all that complex. And there is still possibility for privacy, including psychological privacy, if we value it and we make clear to others that we care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is educating our children to make sure that they remember or are told that the medical relationship is a confidential one. This is extremely important when kids get a little older, especially in their teens. I'm not sure that they are fully aware that there is a tradition of confidentiality in the medical field, and it's for parents to tell them that. That means that the kids are going to be more candid in when they have consultation with a professional, and they have to perhaps be educated because it seems not so plain that the medical relationship is a confidential one.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the vast amount of electrification in this field. So let's make sure our kids realize that at the core of the relationship with a professional is confidentiality, and you have to be assured and can develop that assurance that what you say in the doctor's office will be held in confidence.
Good point.
Robert, if you don't mind me asking a question, this is David again. Gone through some interesting things in the past couple of months, and what keeps coming back to me over and over and over again is that I'm still fairly lucid, and my wife is more so, but I can't imagine. I almost can bring myself to tears thinking that I didn't do enough for my parents, and I look at the 75, 80, 85-year-old person that's going in for anything, just to find out if they're breathing or not, how they could, I mean, it's massive, in my opinion, of what's thrown at you, and how do you keep the elderly safe?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. On the other hand, the elderly don't face the prospect of losing employment, so they have a little bit of leeway there. I think they need a surrogate, clearly, and that's certainly called for in the HIPAA law, and most all, I'm sure, medical practices accept the idea that a surrogate or a next of kin or an associate can be mm-hmm. in the examining room at the same time and be privy to the information. That's very important, and I think all elderly people should have that, even if it's not a family member. And that's the person that can provide the assurance that the information given up is necessary and proper, and that the treating facility has a good reputation for this. I think that's very important.
I think you're right on that one. And just taking a step out of the medical side for a second, it's all about your feeling, your willingness to put your life on your Facebook page and Twitter and all these other places. I think that's where people have let their guard down. It feels like you're just talking to your friends and you know, you are sharing your, you know, you're just pursuing your relationship. But it's bigger than that. When you put information, and kids definitely put a lot of information. When you're going on vacation, that's really not a wise thing to do. To highlight that to the world, or take pictures of where you are, where you can identify where you are, or even what you look like, really, your image, I heard, is being used as well for facial recognition, right? That can be used unbeknownst to you, am I correct?
Oh, absolutely. Facebook is the largest user of facial recognition in the nation, in the world. And I guess that's one area where maybe older people have an advantage because they haven't bought into all this because we didn't have it when we were younger. So that is one advantage. But we don't know the consequences of leaving so many footprints around and mm-hmm. Images of ourselves, especially in compromising positions, and leaving information like that, our home address and going on vacation and all that. We still don't know the implications of that. We see some of the result of it, but I think that in the future it could be cataclysmic when all this information is out and can't be retrieved.
This is true. Or, you know, there's you can geotag your pictures. You have location services on your phone where it tells you. I mean, you're supposed to be able to map things if you're, you know, doing a GPS, but it also maps you. So people can know exactly where you are at all times. And my favorite is the fingerprint, you know, the bio information you get to turn on your iPad or your iPhone. What's the problem with that? And I'm just dubious about that. Where does that go, that biometric information?
Well, I think it might be an improvement, actually. Biometrics is the term I think you were looking for.
Right.
It's the comparison of a physical attribute about you, like your eye movement or your fingerprint, your DNA, and those attributes are stored in a computer so that when you come along and want entry into a secure facility or prove your identity, the match is made. And that could be done with just a thumb scan on a personal computer. And I think if done right, that's a good protection. I think it's much better than use of passwords. And I'm a little surprised it hasn't caught on more. Now, people might be offended by the notion of a fingerprint or a thumbprint, but I think that is much better protection than, passwords. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Or even ATM cards. You know, why not have a thumbprint there at the ATM machine? The people that make these decisions may have found resistance to that. I'm not sure, but I think that that's a good place where we could embrace the technology. The concept in the field is called privacy-enhancing technologies. Mm-hmm. Not every technology has to invade privacy, weaken it. Many can enhance it, and that's one example, I think, in my mind. If it's carefully studied, I think could enhance privacy and security and not the reverse.
You know, I just traveled out of the country not too long ago, and they are using it, the index finger.
You mean the passport people?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they are. It's part of the passport now. Yeah. It's called biometrics.
Yeah, they're also
and
using
in the early
scans.
Days it was used in, I think, a lot of frivolous applications. But I think it ought to be used in personal computers in lieu of a password.
Well, my question is, where does it stop? You know, will it be DNA next, right? Because it's always going to have to be one-upped.
Yeah, well, it will be, and I think the people that are pushing this don't have much regard for human dignity.
There you go.
They worship the machine, but not the individual.
As you all were talking, and you were talking about the facial recognition, what comes to my mind? Mission Impossible. You remember when they'd make the mask of the people and all of this stuff?
Exactly.
Right.
And the fake fingerprints and all these other things. I mean, it just...
Yeah, well, that's with us, as the revelations yesterday through WikiLeaks show. I mean, this is not the future now. This is with us.
Yeah, it is. Well, how can people reach you in the minute we have left?
Oh, thanks for asking. It's Privacy Journal is the newsletter. It's been around for more than 40 years. My name is Robert Ellis Smith, and the newsletter is Privacy Journal, and they can reach me at privacyjournal.net. And there's a place there to send us an email, and I'd be happy to send a sample copy to anybody interested and a list of our books all about protecting your privacy.
Excellent. I'm going to go and peruse the site as soon as we get off air and see what else I can do to enhance my security.
Yeah, look for our tips.
I will. I want to thank you so much for your time. I apologize for missing the beginning of the interview, but I would love it if you can come back in the future.
Great. No, I know Atlanta traffic. Good to join you, Dr. George.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Goodbye. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.